So we've just saluted the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and doing that reminds me to say that everything that we're looking at with the Perfection of Wisdom teachings this weekend all derives from the Buddha. It's part of this stream of wisdom and inspiration that flows from the Buddha down the centuries and takes many, many different forms. So it's just always worth remembering that it roots back to the Buddha and his enlightenment experience, which is a kind of earth-touching, I think, for us. It's always good to remember that. So I wanted to begin by invoking and evoking the spirit of the Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. Amo, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the birthless, all things take their birth. Yet in that birth, nothing is born. Amo, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In the unceasing, all things cease to be. Yet, in that ceasing, nothing ever ceases. Amo, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In non-abiding, everything abides. Yet, thus abiding, there abideth naught. Amo, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In non-perceiving, everything is perceived. Yet that perceiving is quite perceptionless. Amo, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In the unmoving, all things come and go. Yet in that movement, nothing ever moves. So we could actually quite fruitfully probably sit here for the rest of the morning with that and let that percolate into us. It's actually not from the Diamond Sutra, which is the subject of I'm talking about this morning, but it's very much the spirit of the Perfection of Wisdom. And I first heard that probably over 20 years ago during the Mitra study course, and it lodged with me, and it's like a bit of grit that stayed with me and fascinated me ever since. And it's often used as an evocation of the spirit of the Perfection of Wisdom. So, as Badra said last night, just to say, we're not going to sit in silence for an hour. I'm going to actually give you some context for the Perfection of Wisdom and then talk more specifically about the Diamond Sutra, which is a very, very important sutra in the Perfection of Wisdom tradition, as we'll see, and for us in Sri Ratna. So as Badra said last night, wisdom beyond words, which we've got here on the shrine, is a book of Sangharachitas which deals with three of the sutras in what is known as the Perfection of Wisdom tradition. It's a part of the Mahayana tradition, and it's evolved out of early Buddhism. There's lots one could say about the origins of this tradition, but I think the way I've always appreciated understanding it is that there was the historical Buddha, and he taught orally, so nothing was written down. Everything that he taught was memorized and passed on from generation to generation, and that carried on for several hundred years before it started to be written down. And then, so the Buddha was about 500 before the Common Era, before Christ. And about a third century, so hundreds of years after the Buddha, there was a development in this memorising and passing on of the Buddha's teachings called the Abhidharma, and they started to want to make it all a bit tighter and a bit clearer and a bit more systematised, summarised, More and more abstract, actually. It's like they boiled it down and they went, oh, you could have this list and you could have that list, and this ties up like that and this ties up like that. Anyway, the point I want to make is that Sangharakshita, in A Survey of Buddhism, explains that basically they took it so far that they ended up boiling down the Buddha's teachings till they thought you had actual bits of things that didn't change, that weren't impermanent, and that really existed. And that's really problematic, because that's absolutely not the spirit of what the Buddha taught. So they kind of went just way too far in one direction, really. And there's a lovely bit, actually, in the survey where Bhante says, the Abhidharma was a development of the Buddha's teaching, and it can be regarded as legitimate, necessary and helpful, but there's a danger of treating the categories that it uses as metaphysical realities, so actual bits of things, not just as provisional, as a method of explaining things. Yeah? Yes, that's very much an important thing to remember. And he says, thus reducing the scriptures to a gigantic card index system and substituting for insight a retentive memory. So they're very pleased they could remember it all, but actually, basically, the feeling was, and what Bhante says is, that they'd lost the spirit. Yeah? So that's a good way to understand what's happening. With all the Dharma, it's always important to understand the context in which it was taught, because it's taught to correct, always taught to correct a wrong view, and sometimes the wrong view is this way, sometimes it's that way, and the Dharma addresses that. And that's very much what the perfection of wisdom is doing. It's addressing this wrong view that there's anything that is fixed and unchanging. So the perfection of wisdom teachings emerged around about 100 years before the Common Era, it's thought. As I say, you can see it as a way of reconnecting with the spirit of the Buddha's teachings to correct this error. And we know from the Heart Sutra, there's that verse, all things are by nature void. They are not born or destroyed, nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane. So it's very good to have the Heart Sutra as that point of reference to come back to. The Heart Sutra is the most succinct of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. Well, I say that. There is the Perfection of Wisdom. There's a Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 lines. There's a Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines. There's also the Perfection of Wisdom in one letter, which is A, which means not. Well, everything it is not. But for practical purposes, the Heart Sutra is the most succinct presentation of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, and we learn it by heart. It has that key place at the heart of our Sevenfold Puja. And it is really, really worth learning by heart. Then you've got it, and it is interesting how sometimes a part of it will come to mind when you need it. It's the first sutra that Bhante explores in the book Wisdom Beyond Words, and as you know, we're exploring it currently with this great season on Sanghanite that Taranita and Kulajali and Bodhipushpa are doing. And do catch Taranita's talk and Kulajali's sessions there. They're going to be available online, so the Heart Sutra is very important. And the second sutra in the book is known as the Diamond Sutra. The perfection of wisdom that cuts like a diamond. And that's what I'm going to be talking about this morning. One of its most famous verses, which you might have come across, expresses again the essence of the perfection of wisdom. As stars, a fault of vision, as a lamp, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or a cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. As stars, a fault of vision, as a lamp, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. So actually that's another place we could stop. We could stop now going to groups and spend the rest of the weekend discussing that, in fact, but we're not going to. The third sutra in Wisdom Beyond Words is the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, which roughly translates as the verses on the accumulation of the precious qualities of the perfection of wisdom. It's the same perfection of wisdom, but it's a very, very different angle, a very different emphasis on it, as we'll find out tomorrow when Bhadra does his talk on that. But I did want to mention one stanza, another four-line stanza from the Ratnaguna Sanchaigata, which interestingly has just been in the air this week. Those of us who've been involved in the ritual course that finished on Wednesday night, Dharmavadri beautifully led the second part of the evening, and this stanza appeared. And it may well appear later on. I won't say more about that, but there's another strand where it's been appearing. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So I won't say that one twice because we're going to hear it again. But it's called the preliminary admonition at the start of the Ratnaguna Sanchaigata, and it's like, this is what you need to do to prepare yourself. It's the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, but you need, it's for heroic spirits intended. It's challenging. Yeah. Again, we could have the rest of the weekend just on that four lines. So in a way, this weekend's a taster of different approaches to the perfection of wisdom. And I'd really encourage you, if something captures your interest, to follow it up. Bhante's book, Wisdom Beyond Words, is wonderful. You can get it as a hard copy book, you can get it as an e-book. There's also a free audio book online. There's masses in it. But I'm particularly going to talk about the Diamond Sutra. So the Diamond Sutra is pretty short as well. Apparently it's 300 lines in the Sanskrit and Chinese translation. As I said, there's different versions, different lengths of perfection of wisdom. And it's profoundly important in the whole Buddhist tradition, but also in our tradition. And I want to say something about that. Bhante, Sangharakshita, described it as one of the two books by which I have been most profoundly influenced. And I've had this thing for years of being fascinated with what I call the architecture of all of Sangharakshita's thinking. It's this massive mind. He's written, you know, dozens and dozens of books. His thinking, his mind, his thought is like this giant cathedral, really, of Dharma. And often we get interested in one bit that's like a kind of lady chapel off to one side, or we might just want to stay in the central nave. But actually, it's this whole big structure. And within that, this Diamond Sutra is a bit like the keystone in the central arch. And it's about Shunyata. So that's the reason why it's important. It's also the world's earliest dated printed book. By another lovely coincidence, last year Sadajivani gave me this little facsimile from the British Museum. It actually is in the British Museum. And I'll put this on the shrine, actually. It's a facsimile of the actual... It's of a Chinese translation that was done about 400 AD. And... So even kind of in the temporal world, it's a significant book, actually. Yeah. And it's baffling. You may have got a taste of that from the sense of the perfection of wisdom that I evoked earlier. In Wisdom Beyond Words, Bhante says, if we insist that the requirements of the logical mind must be satisfied, we are missing the point. What the Diamond Sutra is actually delivering is not a systematic treatise, but a series of sledgehammer blows, attacking from this side and that, trying to break through our fundamental delusion. This sutra is going to be confusing, irritating, annoying, and unsatisfying. And perhaps we cannot ask for it to be otherwise. If it were all set forth neatly and clearly, leaving no loose ends, we might be in danger of thinking that we had grasped the perfection of wisdom. So again, let's just remind ourselves of the more familiar Heart Sutra. So know that the Bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever but dwelling in Pranya wisdom, is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. All Buddhas of past and present Buddhas of future time, using this prajna wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. So the crucial bit is holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in prajna wisdom. So this wisdom isn't something we can grasp with our rational minds. It's something we need to learn how to dwell in. We need to be able to let go of the grip of the conceptual mind and dwell in a much greater mandala of awareness, which is part of Bhadra's territory for tomorrow. Having said that, I want to give you a little bit more historical context. This sutra itself was said to have been transmitted orally, without being written down, for hundreds of years after the Buddha's parinirvana, his death. And they say it was written down in the 2nd century of the Common Era, and then it was translated from Sanskrit into Chinese in about 400. And this edition that is in the British Library was produced in about 868 AD, Common Era. So that's 1,151 years ago. And it was over 500 years before anything was printed in Europe. There's a lovely story, actually, about how the manuscript was stored away in a cave within a cave in a monastery in China, and it was sealed up, and it stayed sealed up for 1,000 years. The story's in here. I'll leave this around, actually, so you can look if you want. There's loads and loads of other translations. There were 6 translations into Chinese just in the first few hundred years. It's translated in Tibetan, Mongolian, Manch, Sogdian, whatever that is, Cotonese, French, German, Japanese. There are over a dozen English translations. And one of the things that is significant in terms of the Buddhist tradition as a whole is that it was a huge, major influence on the Mahayana tradition, and particularly Zen. So the 6th patriarch of Zen, Huineng, was said to have been an uneducated layman, and he gained enlightenment when he heard the Diamond Sutra. And it is interesting that at the same time when Bante, Sangharakshita, came across the Diamond Sutra, he came across the Sutra of Huineng. And that's the other book that has had the most profound influence on him of those 2 books that he mentioned. So I love this story about Bante coming across the Diamond Sutra. So he was 16 or 17, and it was in Watkins Bookshop. You might have been to Watkins Bookshop. I've been there loads of times. It's in Cecil Court in London, just off the Charing Cross Road. And I wanted to just read you the bit from Bante's memoirs, because I just really enjoyed it when I came across it again. So he'd been on holiday, and he says, he thinks it was late summer. So he's 16, 17, because his birthday's at the end of August. Return to London meant a renewal of acquaintance with the bookshops on the Charing Cross Road. Expanding my sphere of operations, I began penetrating into 2 or 3 of the little courts which opened from it on the right. In one of these, I discovered the Oriental Bookshop, which, though well known to all students of Eastern philosophy and religion, had been until then unknown to me. Unlike the other bookshops, with their sixpenny and shilling boxes on either side of a wide open door, it was an aloof, reserved, almost mysterious place. In a single box outside the empty window on the left were some damaged specimens of the lighter sort of theosophical literature. The windows on the right contained expensive books on the occult sciences. The door between was shut fast. Only after I had several times stopped to thumb the damaged volumes did I venture inside. The interior of the shop was even less like that of a bookshop than the exterior, though through the door at the back of the shop could be seen an octogenarian gentleman in very powerful spectacles sitting at a desk. Above the mantelpiece behind him hung a life-size photograph of Madame Blavatsky. At John Watkins, which thereafter I visited frequently, I bought the 2 books by which I have been most profoundly influenced. These were the Diamond Sutra, which I read first in Gemmell and then Max Müller's translation, and the Sutra of Huineng. If, when I read Isis Unveiled, that's Madame Blavatsky's book, I knew that I was not a Christian, when I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew that I was a Buddhist. Even though this book epitomizes a teaching of such refined sublimity that even arahants, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to have become confused and afraid when they heard it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before. And the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. I don't know how many times he's told that story. It comes up again and again, and it's absolutely a pivotal moment. And I've been fascinated by it for years. It really is describing an experience of a moment of vision, vision with a capital V, and the fact that that then unfolded over all those decades afterwards. It unfolded into his extraordinary life. It's unfolded into our extraordinary order and movement. It seems to me that that really perfectly exemplifies what he talks about in Vision and Transformation, that book on the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, when he talks about vision. An experience of a glimpse of something that changes how we see the world, or names something we already know that we haven't been able to name before. And having experienced it, or glimpsed it, or named it, it carries on having an effect. And it causes us to transform in response to what we've seen or experienced. That's something we could explore in our groups later. What have those glimpses, experiences been for us? In a way, that might be our glimpse of the perfection of wisdom, or, well, as Badra was saying last night, when the Naga princess has appeared. So I really wanted to understand how it was that this coming across the Dhyana Sutra could have such a profound effect on Sangharakshita at the age of 16 or 17. He hadn't meditated, he'd read massively, but this one thing had such a huge effect. But I was also aware that in terms of what had been affecting his consciousness, he'd been reading poetry from a very early age, and he's talked again quite often about being strongly affected by reading Milton when he was 12, meeting William Blake when he was 14. And I also know from his memoirs that there came a point when he was living in Kalimpong where he realised that poetry and the Dharma weren't different. He was teaching, he had students then that he was teaching for exams. He was teaching them English for an exam, but he says, One day, once I'd done my duty by the students and provided them with a sort of paraphrase of the poem that they wanted, I felt free to go beyond the examination requirements. So you could say the requirements of the logical mind. Taking the poem that I'd dictated as my starting point, I tried to communicate to them something of the real meaning of the poem as an expression of an intense emotional and intellectual experience. An experience that was of universal significance and value. One day, the class was particularly attentive, and I was feeling more than usually inspired. I was explaining the last verse of Shelley's poem, The Cloud, and discovering in it greater and greater depths of meaning, when suddenly I realised that I was teaching the students Buddhism. It was not that I'd forgotten about the poem I was supposed to be explaining and had unconsciously slipped into teaching Buddhism. Instead, in explaining the poem, I was teaching Buddhism. This could only mean that at a certain level of experience, poetry and the Dharma were the same thing. It was a sense in which beauty was truth and truth beauty. And even if this was not all that I needed to know on earth, it had at least become clear to me that my interest in poetry was not incompatible with a spiritual life. So that had been his massive conflict up until then. Sangharakshita to the poem, a poet, Sangharakshita to the monk. So there's this sense of this coming together. And I think what this is pointing to is that the truth that's in the perfection of wisdom is the same truth that we can find in poetry. Well, he'll say more later about this. You can find it in many different places. It doesn't have to be in a sutra with Perfection of Wisdom written on the cover. So I was just very interested in this connection between poetry and the Diamond Sutra, particularly in the Dharma, and I decided to ask some of my more experienced, in preparing this talk, I decided to ask some people I know in the order with lots of experience what they thought about this connection, because I felt it was really important for us, this whole thing about how we translate the Dharma into Western culture, what's going on in Bhante's experience that brings all this together. So I wrote to Padma Vajra, who wrote back almost straight away, and he said, it's Bhante's imaginative identification that's important. And he says that Bhante said at one time that when he reads, for example, Plotinus, he becomes a Neoplatonist. And another time he said when he was hearing Milton, he felt like he was inhabiting Milton's vast consciousness. So reading for him is a profound imaginative and spiritual experience. And then he said this lovely line I really liked. He said, there is an acute and refined sensitivity which can go anywhere. So he can just enter these different realms. So he entered the realm of Blake, he entered the realm of Milton, then he enters this realm of the Perfection of Wisdom at the age of 16. Poetry, this is Padma Vajra, poetry and religious texts for him cannot be separated. Aesthetic and transcendental experience flow into one another. In Bhante's early poetry, it comes across with great simplicity and directness. And there's another interesting coincidence, synchronicity moment here, because this verse that I'm about to read is the very verse that Taranita and Kulajani chose for the blurb for their season on the Heart Sutra. It's three lines of Sangharakshita from a poem called The Unseen Flower. And Bhante says, compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness when you yourself are not there. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness when you yourself are not there. And Padma Vajra concluded, perhaps you could see this as a restatement of the Diamond Sutra in the simplest of terms. He went on to point me at a talk of Bhante's where he's talking about dreams and rebirth. It's a very interesting talk. And Bhante says, Padma Vajra said, maybe we're not dealing with a continuity in this life. Maybe the Diamond Sutra is of a different order that can't be reduced to anything before. You know, where did his this... Well, Bhante says, I recognise something I had forgotten. And in this talk that I listened to, Bhante says, from the very beginning, there was a very definite direction of my life, of my whole force of being. And he describes encountering a Buddha figure when he was 8, and then when he was 12 or 13, buying a little Buddha figure in Brighton and buying some incense and lighting incense in front of it, and he didn't know what he was doing. I came across the translations of the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Hui Neng, and when I read these, especially the Diamond Sutra, I at once felt, this is what I really believe. This is what I have believed all the time. I have always believed what this sutra teaches. This was my actual experience, my actual realization at the time. And he goes on to say, so sometimes I wonder, where did this tremendous urge come from? This urge which has played such a dominant part in my life for 60 years. I look back and think of what sort of surroundings I was born into. Very ordinary working class surroundings in Tooting of all places. So what was there to account for my interest? I can only presume that in all likelihood it was some powerful samskara or habit pattern, samskara carried over from a previous existence which had impelled me to follow a path I had followed before and to reconnect with teachings and practices and experiences with which I had been connected in previous lives. And he goes on and he says, so this has always been to me one of the considerations which has led me to accept the idea of rebirth. So he goes on in the talk to say quite a lot about why he says it's a consideration. And he says, fundamentally because the consideration, it's not a proof, it's just something to bear in mind that kind of points in that direction, points to staying open-minded about that. And I think the reason this is important to us as we approach the Diamond Sutra is that we've got this document in historical time, but actually it's the perfection of wisdom which is outside of space and time. And again, it's asking us to expand our consciousnesses between this mundane material, from this mundane material world, to something altogether vaster. So Panavajra only wrote to me. He didn't write to the other people that I wrote to. But then I had an email from Perna in New Zealand, who said almost the same thing as Panavajra, which was interesting. He recalled an anecdote that Bhante's companion Paramartha had told about this capacity of Bhante's to be receptive. Oh, very open, to go anywhere kind of receptivity. And he described it as a susceptibility. So very open, receptive, susceptibility. And he tells this story of Bhante in 2018. He was having read to him Carlo Rovelli's book, Reality is Not What It Seems. So this is a book about quantum physics, I think. And Bhante wrote this note, science and about science and poetry. And he mentions Rovelli, and Rovelli also refers to Dante, the poet Dante, and his Paradiso, and how great science and great poetry are both visionary and may even arrive at the same intuitions. Dante moves us deeply, touching other sources of our emotion. Einstein opens a road towards the unsolved mysteries of our universe. But both count as among the most beautiful and significant flights that the mind can achieve. And Paramartha's described how he saw Bhante after he'd been listening to this stuff, and he said he was in a state of shock, actually. And it actually affected him for 2 days after he'd been listening to this. Perna concluded, one of the personal reflections this has drawn me into was the strength of feeling and connection that Bhante is able to make in certain situations, not approaching things superficially. I suspect we need to understand the impact of the Diamond Sutra on him as a young man in terms of this susceptibility, this openness. So, in terms of what we ourselves practice and how we ourselves approach the Diamond Sutra, this all points us very squarely at receptivity, that aspect of our system of practice that says whatever things we're doing, integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, we need receptivity right in the heart of it. We need to be able to be open. We need to be able to respond, not just with the head, but with much more of our beings, with our emotions, with our imaginations. When the wisdom's beyond words, obviously our head isn't going to be able to grasp it. And I spent quite a while looking for this quote that I was convinced was from Bhante about this, and then I realised actually from a very famous Blake scholar, about the difference between knowledge and wisdom. It's difficult for the man who has knowledge without wisdom to relax his mind into receptivity in front of a picture or poem. To him, it contains a communicable residue, a communicable residue of general statements called the meaning. And to clutch this and carry it off is his sole desire. So it's like, go in, grab the meaning and make off, not actually be in relationship, be affected by, be changed by what it is that you're coming into relationship with. I think this reminds me of what I was saying at the start about the Abhidharma, and in a way they boiled down the Dharma to bits that they felt perhaps they could carry off and understand. So there was one other response I received to these explorations, and two more. One was from Buddhadasa, who's in Melbourne in Australia. And he made a really good point he was the one who really made me think we mustn't get hung up on the literalness of the Diamond Sutra. Actually, it could have been anything that Bhante read that really had the truth in it at 16. But it was the Diamond Sutra. But when the disciple is ready, the master will appear. So the Diamond Sutra appeared to Bante when he was ready at 16. And the Dharma will reveal itself when conditions align. He said, a moment in time spoke to the timeless. And he remembered, Buddhadasa was here for a few years. He came over from Australia to look after Bante for some of the last few years when Bante was here. And he remembers Bante once saying to him when he was here, the Dharma teaches itself. The Dharma teaches itself. So what does the sutra actually say? Let's come back to the Diamond Sutra. So this little book from the British Libraries got 145-word summary of the whole sutra. So I thought I'd share that with you, because I thought that was quite neat. Like most sutras, it begins with a description of the scene. Having begged for food, the Buddha ate and then settled down in a grove of trees, surrounded by many monks, to answer the questions posed by his elderly disciple, Subhuti. Subhuti asked the Buddha how to achieve bodhisattvahood. Bodhisattvas being believers who had achieved nirvana, an escape from the endless cycle of rebirths, but chosen to stay behind in the world to save others. The Buddha stresses that bodhisattvahood cannot be defined in terms of the physical world. In turn, he asks Subhuti if it's possible to define the physical characteristics of Buddhahood. And having listened to the Buddha, Subhuti says it isn't. Then the Buddha tells Subhuti and the assembled monks that thousands of jewels are worthless in comparable with a recitation of the sutra, which would bring incalculable merit. That's it. So I thought that was quite interesting. Perhaps that's another bit of communicable residue. You know, it's kind of boiled it down to this little story. That's the whole of this sutra that's had this massive effect throughout the whole Buddhist tradition, well, a lot of the Buddhist tradition. So why should we bother with it? Well, let's look at the title. The title, we call it the Diamond Sutra. It's actually the Vajracchedika Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom that cuts like a vajra. Diamond translates vajra, but actually that's only translating half of the word vajra, because actually a vajra is a diamond thunderbolt. There's a bit more going on. And we've looked at that. I've sat actually in this very chair, in this very room, and talked about this, I think, the year before last. Because what you have in the vajra is one end, you've got the five prongs, which are the five poisons, greed, hatred, delusion, conceit, envy. You've got, normally there's a sphere. Obviously, this is a kind of homemade vajra. This bit in the middle symbolises a sphere, which is shunyata. And then the other end, you've got the five wisdoms, or the five enlightened aspects of the Buddha's mind. Last year, we looked at the five spiritual faculties, faith, wisdom, energy, samadhi, and mindfulness. You know, so the poisons can transform through shunyata, but you need to break through. So the diamond cutter is cutting away at the delusions that stop us reaching towards this enlightened mind, manifesting this enlightened mind. And it's interesting because in the Buddhist tradition, the vajra is associated with compassion. The vajra bell, actually I haven't got one here, but the vajra bell is associated with wisdom. The vajra is associated with compassion. And I thought, actually, you could see it's a symbol of unbreakable kindness. Unbreakable kindness. So what does the Diamond Sutra cut? Well, it cuts away all ignorance. All the suffering that the Buddha talks about in the Four Noble Truths comes from our clinging to wrong views about the nature of reality. It comes from our ignorance. All of that suffering in the Four Noble Truths, the Diamond Sutra is aiming to free us from that. And the Buddha said, all us ordinary people are mad because from an enlightened point of view, we behave as if things that change are permanent, as if unreal things are real, as if painful things are pleasant and ugly things are beautiful. These are called the viparyasas, or the topsy-turvy views. So we just keep going around the wheel because of these views, and we need to be, well, in a way it's cutting us free of the wheel, you could say. Yeah. So that we can begin to ascend the spiral path. So that suffering, dukkha, doesn't lead to craving and grasping and keeping going around the wheel. It leads to faith, to joy, rapture, and so on. The Diamond Sutra comes with a health warning. In fact, the whole perfection of wisdom comes with a health warning. It's strong stuff. Remember, Bhante said it can be confusing, irritating, annoying, and unsatisfying. But it can also be dangerous. And he says somewhere else, and Ken Jyoti was remembering this the other day, if you're going to look at things like this, you need to know where your friends are. You need to know where your friends are. If we don't approach it with enough positive emotion and integration, it can be unhelpful. One of the things Bhante says in Wisdom Beyond Words is, the perfection of wisdom is like salt. An exclusive diet of it probably wouldn't do you much good. But you need a pinch of it in your spiritual diet all the time. It gives a little flavour, a flavour of irrelevance. So I suspect Bhadra might be talking about the territory of irrelevance tomorrow. And there's another health warning, which comes actually from the 7th century, from this scholar called Chandrakirti, and I love it. It saved me when I was a Mitra, because I loved all the Shunyata stuff, because I hated myself and wanted to use all this Vajric stuff to kind of lop off all the bits of myself that I didn't like, and wasn't very helpful. There was no metta in it, not very much. And Chandrakirti says, it's better to have a view of the self as high as Mount Sumeru than to have the wrong idea of emptiness, of Shunyata. Because if you are sick, then medicine can cure you. But if your medicine has become your poison, what hope do you have? So it's very similar to the thing about salt. You know, a bit can be medicine, but actually too much can be poison. You need this mandala of the different faculties. You need positive emotion. You need integration. So it's interesting, in the sutra itself has the Buddha talking to this character, Subhuti, the historical Subhuti, obviously, who was one of the Buddha's main 10 disciples. And what I didn't know till I started preparing this talk is that the disciples all have different qualities that they're renowned for. And Subhuti was the foremost in giving gifts, and also he was renowned for his practice of the metta bhavana. And when he went round every day, on his alms round, it said that he used to cultivate metta jhana at the door of each house before he went. So it's a dhyana of metta, a very positive, refined mental state of metta before he went to each house. So the Buddha would have known this. He's giving Subhuti this teaching because he knows he can take it. You know, he's really... But also, it's that thing of he was, you know, he had a lot of that. Perhaps he needed a bit of this. But he wasn't lacking in positive emotion. Yeah. Time's getting on. There's not loads one could say about the structure of the sutra. If you look at it, it actually isn't a beautifully structured sutra. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do a perfect 10-point one side of A4 summary, as some of you know I'm quite fond of. And interestingly, down the years, the different commentators also struggled with this, until finally one of them realised that what we've got in the sutra is the Buddha's responses to Subhuti. But they only wrote down the Buddha's responses. They didn't write down what Subhuti said. And what Subhuti was saying was all his doubts. So we've only got, like, these responses. It's very, very interesting. But Han Shan managed to work out, by some mysterious means, that Subhuti had 35 doubts. There were 17 coarse doubts and 18 subtle doubts. Yeah, and somewhere in my researches I found a summary of what the three main areas were, and then I lost it again. But anyway, I think the point is here about doubt. And I think the fact is we all have our own doubts, and in a way the message of the Diamond Sutra is that all our sufferings derive from these views, which include our doubts, that get in our way, that stop us becoming free. So doubt would be an interesting one. What doubts could you be cut free from by the perfection of wisdom? That might be an interesting one for the groups. Yeah. So, in this last section of the talk, I'm just going to share some very brief passages from the sutra. As the sutra itself said, and Bhante's also often said, we don't need vast quantities of the Dharma. We just need to really engage with a few lines that really speak to us and challenge us and enable us to change. And in fact, right at the end of the sutra, the Buddha says, you could Bodhisattva could fill world systems immeasurable and incalculable with the seven precious things, give them to the Tathagatas and the Arahants. You know, they could do all these massive offerings. On the other hand, a son or daughter of good family could take but one stanza of four lines of the Prajnaparamita, bear it in mind, demonstrate, recite, study and illuminate it for others, and that latter would beget a greater heap of merit. So it's a massive, to really engage even with four lines is a massively meritorious, beneficial practice. So near the beginning is this one paragraph that pretty much epitomises the whole paradox in the perfection of wisdom and the Bodhisattva ideal. I won't read you the whole paragraph, but the crucial aspects. A Bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner, as many beings as there are in this universe of beings, all these I must lead to Nirvana. So the Bodhisattva vows to save all beings. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to Nirvana, no being at all has been led to Nirvana. He is not to be called a Bodhisattva in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. So what this is saying is that the Bodhisattva from compassion vows to save all beings, from wisdom knows that there are no beings to save. That's the huge, challenging paradox at the heart of the Dharma Sutra. I was going to say something about how we might approach that through the two truths of absolute and relative truth, or conventional and absolute truth. I don't have time to go into that, but I'll mention that for people leading the groups in case it's helpful. The heart of it is this clinging to the idea that there is a definite outcome to be achieved. It comes back again and again to ego clinging and clinging to this fixating. Fixation is another word that's been used quite a lot in translations of the sutra. Fixing in any way. We're back to holding to nothing whatever. The difference between holding to something and coursing. And it brought to mind Blake, that very famous stanza of Blake that you've probably all heard, and it's got a lot of wisdom in it. He who binds to himself a joy doth the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. He who binds to himself a joy doth the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. That summary from the British Museum mentioned the Buddha asking Subhuti if he could recognise the Buddha by his physical characteristics, by his form. You could say, for those of you who were here last year, his Nirmanakaya. The Buddha's got these three bodies, form body, glorious imaginal body, and ultimate Dharmakaya body. And there's this very famous stanza, which is another really pith part of the Diamond Sutra. Those who by my form did see me, those who followed me by voice, this is the Buddha speaking, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddha. From Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet, Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. That's another one that's lodged in my mind ever since that Mitra course where we met the perfection of wisdom. And a couple of years ago, I started singing and it acquired a tune. Those who by my form did see me, those who followed me by voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in, me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas, from Dharma bodies comes their guidance, so should we see, yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. The final passage that I wanted to share is the one I shared at the start. As stars, a fault of vision as a lamp, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, a cloud. So should one view what is conditioned. I think we'll leave it there. That's probably enough. It's 12:30.